From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning we speak with award-winning environmental journalist Marco Vischer about the rise, fall, and return of our mightiest, most feared, and most misunderstood energy source, nuclear. His new book is called The Power of Nuclear, and it is a very readable and approachable history and current look at nuclear from all sides of this controversial topic. Then, have you ever wondered what lurked beneath the surface of oceans, rivers, and streams during the age of dinosaurs? Randy Ermus, who's the curator of paleontology at the Natural History Museum of Utah, joins us to talk about the Dino Fest coming up this Saturday and Sunday that uncovers these little-known dinosaurs, which are actually called marine reptiles. All that coming up on Cool Science Radio when we return. Stay with us. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Our next guest, Marco Vischer, is an award-winning journalist from the Netherlands. Over the last 25 years, he has written extensively about climate policy and clean technology for leading newspapers and magazines. Today, he joins us to explore the past and the future of nuclear power, which he calls the most powerful and misunderstood energy source on which society has turned its back. He has written a new book on the subject titled The Power of Nuclear, The Rise, Fall, and Return of Our Mightiest Energy Source. Marco Vischer, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
This book is so interesting. I feel like it's a book that you could read over and over and over. And to encapsulate what I feel like it's about is looking at the entire history of how we got to where we all are with our individual beliefs about nuclear power. It's whether we're scared of it or whether we embrace it and why. Maybe we should start with this, your personal story about what your thoughts are about nuclear power.
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks so much for saying all this. Yeah, when my first piece of writing about nuclear power was from the year 2000, and I was very much an opponent of nuclear power. I was writing an article about a UN climate change conference, and the nuclear industry was present at that summit, and it was promoting its product as the answer to global warming. I wrote a piece about that, and you could see from how I wrote about this event was I was just mind boggled. I was bewildered at just this suggestion that the nuclear power industry could actually do something good for our planet. I think the last line of my article back then was, it is time to destroy the nuclear industry before it will destroy our planet, or something like that. I was writing back then for a small alternative magazine, I will add. Now, over time, I eased up a little bit. I think it was around the year 2010 or so when some environmental heroes of mine were speaking out in favor of nuclear power. And this included Stuart Brand, for instance, and James Lovelock, both figureheads in the 1960s and 70s. They were saying that nuclear power has so much to offer when it comes to tackling climate change because it is a zero carbon energy source that's available 24/7. I read it and I thought it was interesting, but I guess I was never so much interested, but because I was willing to accept that nuclear power was a necessary evil, if you will. But I thought wind and solar were so much better. We just have to increase wind and solar, right? And then we'll have the problem solved. Now, I guess I became a little bit more nuanced about that once I had written a book on the energy transition, only available in Dutch. And I realized that we are lacking a source that is available around the clock, and that is nuclear. So it was only then that I really started looking in nuclear power. And from then on, it's actually fairly quickly I realized the benefits of nuclear power. And when I tell the story of how I changed my mind, I never think, oh, how special. There's always something special about a story of a convert, but I don't think this is so special. I always wonder, why on earth did it take me so long before I realized the benefits and uses of nuclear power?
This is very interesting. So you went from being a harsh opponent to, is it fair to say that you are a proponent? Because your book, I have to say, is not about being a proponent of nuclear power. It's about educating people about what it is and also what it was.
Yeah, true. Well, I don't mind saying that I am a proponent of nuclear power. I think it will be very useful for us to increase our nuclear fleet and get more power from nuclear power plants, of course. But I never wrote my book in order to convince people of my point of view. I was more, people always ask, so what should we do with nuclear power? But I think a much more interesting question for the book that I was writing was, what is nuclear power doing to us? Because I notice whenever I would do public speaking events here in the Netherlands, and it was about climate policy, and a lot of talk is about wind and solar. And then there's always someone in the audience raising his hand saying, oh, what about nuclear power? And then, or I would raise the topic for that matter, but oh, something would happen in the room. People would start being uncomfortable, or they would start yelling, no, we don't want nuclear. And other people would start clapping and applauding and cheering. And I thought, well, that's interesting. This never happens when we talk about, hydrogen or batteries, right? There's something about nuclear power that makes us uncomfortable, or it makes us very exciting. But there is something special about this technology, and that's something I wanted to explore.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Marco Vischer. He is the author of the new book, The Power of Nuclear: The Rise, Fall, and Return of Our Mightiest Energy Source. Marco, I think I know that we've had other people on the show that are very pro-nuclear. And as soon as we air the show, we get so many emails of people that are just against it and they're angry with us for promoting it. And when a nuclear accident happens, it's pretty massive. But I was fascinated to read in your book about all the details of the Japanese Daiichi plant that went down during the 2011 tsunami. And then I don't want to say misinformation, but the perceptions that we were fed, if you will, about what actually happened. So give us a little background on what actually caused that plant failure other than the tsunami itself.
Yeah. So indeed, in 2011, there was a massive earthquake followed by a massive tsunami. The power supply broke down. So the cooling system failed in one of the reactors. And it was followed a couple of days later by three meltdowns in the reactors at the Fukushima nuclear power plant. I think it's very instructive to look at what happened or what didn't happen in Fukushima, because this is a typical accident that people fear. This is a meltdown in a modern reactor in a modern country. Now, first thing to note is that back then, when this happened, these meltdowns, nobody was hospitalized with radiation burns, as was the case in Chernobyl, for instance. Nobody had acute radiation sickness syndrome. Now, two reports have been published since about the long-term effects. These reports were published by the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, UNSCEAR. And what they're saying is there is no discernible increase in health effects linked to radiation exposure. So there's no increase in cancer, no increase in birth defects or heart attacks, nor does the UN Commission expect such an increase. And why is that? It's because the radiation dose incurred by the population was, in the words of the UN, low or very low. Our bodies seem to cope with that level of radiation. So the science is clear. Nobody died from radiation released in Fukushima, and nobody will die from it. However, there is a public health crisis due to the accident in Fukushima. There's been an increase in depression. an increase in post-traumatic stress, in alcoholism, obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure. And this is especially the case amongst people who had to evacuate. And this kind of makes sense. These were people who lost their homes. They lost their jobs, their sense of community, sense of belonging. This public health crisis is not the result of exposure to radiation. It's the result of exposure to the idea that a nuclear disaster struck and that these people are doomed. And it's also, it's not because of the evacuation that the radiation dose was low for them and that there are no health effects. In fact, experts from several universities looking back at the evacuation deemed the whole evacuation a mistake. The levels of radiation were low, and I hope that when the next accident comes, and we cannot exclude that that option, I hope the government response will not be the same as the response from the Japanese government.
Well, let's talk about the public health effects of existing power sources. I mean, we look at the acute effects of a nuclear plant meltdown, Chernobyl, for example, but is anybody actually adding up the numbers of the climate change effects from coal burning power plants? That's got to have a bigger number, but it's happening long term slowly, or even as we try and transition into the, you know, quote unquote greener energies with solar and wind, the mining of those minerals that we need to create the batteries, the land usage that they take up. But I'm not against that. I just think that we need to really see it for what it is. It's not a completely green source. But what do those numbers look like in terms of actual human consequences as opposed to nuclear?
Yeah, that's a great question. And studies have been done looking at fatalities of all the energy sources available. So they look indeed at mining, transportation of fuels and waste management, for instance. And if we tally up the fatalities per kilowatt hour, what you see very clearly is that coal and natural gas, they come on top. And all the way at the bottom sits nuclear along with solar and wind. This makes a lot of sense because for coal and natural gas plants, it's not just greenhouse gases they emit. They're emitting air pollutants, right? And every year, millions of premature deaths are recorded because of air pollution coming from these fossil fuel plants. And that's when they work well, right? We've been talking about what happens when nuclear plants have an accident, but this is just common practice for normally functioning coal and gas plants.
Yes, that's such an interesting point, and point I'm sure we need to explore further. It seems to me that people, unlike maybe the way we look at fossil fuels and the relative safety, we have some really big disasters in the past, and with when it comes to nuclear. And you know, going back to 1945, when the Americans dropped two atomic bombs on Japan in the space of 3 days, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people died immediately. To fast forward to Chernobyl in 1986. And it interesting at the time, I didn't know this, but if you look up how many people died from Chernobyl, it was between 30 and 60 immediately. The long-term effects, you don't know how many people died eventually from thyroid cancer or leukemia or whatever it is. But 80 years later, what did you find in researching this book? Can we guarantee the safety of using nuclear power, or can we not?
I guess the nuclear industry will say nuclear power is safe. Many proponents of nuclear power will say that nuclear power is safe. But, you know, nothing in life is safe, right? I mean, if you take a plane, you're sitting in a chair in the sky at dazzling speed. That's not exactly the definition of safe, right? But we've made it safe enough for people to board a plane. And this is the same thing with nuclear power. It's safe enough to operate. We hardly have any other energy sources that are safer, right? So, but it's interesting you raise atomic bombs as well. Those were the true nuclear disasters, of course, right? And I think the atomic bomb is so important in how we came to think about nuclear power plants. I mean, this was the way nuclear power was introduced to the world, right? It was introduced with the atomic bomb. Now that makes quite a bit of an impact in how we think about the splitting of atoms. It's not the greatest PR stunt ever, I guess, to introduce something like this in a bomb. That's also why the first chapter of my book is all about the atomic bomb. I got a lot of slack from criticism, I mean, from proponents of nuclear power, saying that I spend way too much words on the atomic bomb, because they want to make that distinction so clear. Nuclear weapons is something completely different from nuclear power. But I think it is so important for us to understand the impact of atomic bombs that I wanted to start the book with it. It feels so weird to be writing about the history and future of nuclear power and then forget all about nuclear weapons.
So true. And it also really explains why there's probably so much opposition to nuclear power. You know, we as humans operate on a lot of emotion about things. And yes, I mean, when I was reading the first chapters of your book, it just shines a light on how there's such a contradiction with nuclear, right? It's something that can destroy our world. And it's something that, when used in the right way, it can power our world, and especially power a world in which we have bigger and bigger. Our needs for power and electrification are growing exponentially with, you know, the idea of switching away from fossil fuels and also powering things like AI. It seems like, you know, if someone were to read your book, I feel like you did it, or did you do this, so we can understand what our human come from is, what our human reaction is to nuclear, and then start from a place of just more clarity.
So throughout human history, we have known scarcity. We never had enough energy, right? We needed to burn down trees, dig up coal from underground. And then suddenly, say in the early 50s, there was nuclear power. And this was the first time we were able to produce electricity with resources that were widely abundant on the Earth, uranium, and it's available on all continents, and we only need a little, right? Just to give you an impression here, just 1 gram of uranium has the same amount of energy as 3,000 tons of coal. It's mind-boggling. This is amazing, and it's clean. I mean, whoever was in a coal mine knows the dirt that's on your body, just everywhere. There's dirty air with these black smoke. But a nuclear power plant could finally provide clean and cheap, abundant energy. That was very much the story in the 1950s. And there was a lot of enthusiasm about this. And along the way, and this happened fairly quickly, I should say, people started having doubts about nuclear power, about this potential. And these doubts, they were probably based on the atomic bomb, because alongside the build out of this nuclear fleet with power plants, especially sponsored by the US government, of course, was also an expansion of the arsenal on nuclear weapons. And people were scared of a nuclear war, and rightly so. This made a lot of sense with, you know, the Cold War had just started. And many people were wondering, when will the first atomic bomb, the next one, when will it fall? And then a nuclear war would break out. People were concerned about nuclear war. They wanted a ban on nuclear weapons. What they got was a ban on testing, at least in the atmosphere. So there would be no more fallout. And this eased people's minds to some extent, because they didn't have to worry about the health consequences of radioactive fallout. Now, when the testing moved underground, they saw all these nuclear power plants that were being built on industrial sites. And they were wondering, might that be a source of fallout? That's a radiation source over there, right? Could it maybe explode like a bomb? So people, in psychology, the word is displacement. People transferred their fears from nuclear war, from nuclear weapons, over to nuclear power plants. This is also very much in the origin story of Greenpeace, for instance, which was an organization protesting against nuclear weapons and transitioned fairly easily into an environmental organization protesting against nuclear power plants.
Well, Marco, let's talk about the energy use, because Lynn just brought up how our world is becoming more and more reliant on electrification and specifically AI. And we've recently talked to people, someone in the Netherlands, in fact, who did a study on the massive amounts of energy that AI requires. And so now I'm seeing stories about the Bill Gates and these other tech giants becoming more interested again, or not even again, just becoming more interested in nuclear power. What are you seeing through this, and do you think this could be a benefit?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a real challenge providing all the energy that is required in the next decades or so, and not just because of AI and data centers, etc. But it's especially in developing countries where the demand for energy will be growing tremendously. Like by 2050, it's expected the world will double its energy use compared to 2020. What I'm seeing is it's going to be really difficult to phase out fossil fuels. We just need to build more and more power plants and maybe accept that in some countries the choice will be for coal-fired power plants and natural gas plants because they're quicker to build. There will be many more wind farms, there will be many more solar farms, because we need all the electricity we can get. And I just hope that regulations will ease up a little bit so it becomes easier to expand the nuclear fleet here as well. What we're seeing now with big tech companies is they're looking for these small modular reactors. So this is sort of an advanced nuclear where electricity, clean electricity, comes to provide these data centers that they need so much. It makes a lot of sense. But I should say, I'm a little bit hesitant to believe all the great stories, the great media stories that are out there about this innovation. I think we're just being a little bit naive when we believe all the fantastic PowerPoint presentations about new reactors. None of them have really been built, right? And it's mostly these presentations come from startup companies looking for investors, right? Maybe it works fantastic eventually, but we don't really know. What we do know is how these big, clunky nuclear reactors work that we've had experience with for decades on end. So I think innovation is great. Let's pursue this, but let's not put a brake on building these big reactors that we will also need. And we know that these actually work and can decarbonize a modern economy.
So Lynn and I both know that we're going to get pushback from our listeners, and they're going to say, well, how can you support this? This is a dangerous form of energy creation. What can we say to them in addition to reading your book, which is such a great information source, very non-biased, here's the facts. But as people push back against this, especially, in our conversations, what would you say is the one point we can really drive home to skeptics?
It's such a great question, and it's not an easy one. What I have noticed in the many conversations I had with people who don't like nuclear power is that their concerns seem to shift all the time. So if I would talk about the nuclear accident in Fukushima, for instance, they would say, okay, so it may not be so unsafe as I thought, but what about the waste? And I would explain, well, waste is not so much of an issue either. It has never made anyone sick. It has never killed anyone. We know perfectly well what to do with nuclear waste. It's a small problem. And then they move on to the next. They say, well, we don't have enough uranium on Earth? And I say, well, there's plenty of uranium. There's even uranium in the ocean. So it seems that they're always looking for ways to not accept that nuclear can actually do something really good for our planet and for us humans here. So I wish you good luck with addressing these the questions and concerns from your readers. What may help is that scientists are very clear about the benefits of nuclear power. So when it comes to climate, for instance, there's the International Energy Agency urging governments not to close down nuclear plants, but build nuclear plants. There's, of course, the IPCC, UN's Climate Change Commission, saying that nuclear power is a climate solution. There are other UN organizations saying it's an indispensable tool that we should use if we want to meet climate targets, etc. It's scientists who have shown the low fatality rate for nuclear power. It's scientists who have said, who can prove that nuclear waste is not something you should be worried about. So I guess refer them to science would be another way, apart from referring to my book, I guess.
Well, certainly nuclear power is a convenient villain, but it's also, as you call it, a necessary evil. And I'm wondering, the opposite of Katie's question, when we talk to those people who are, go nuclear, that's the only way, you know, what can we also say to them to maybe temper or bring down or bring reality to their excitement? And the question that comes up for me is something like, well, okay, so we can't store wind or solar, but at what point can we store wind and solar? At what point can wind and solar be a better option than nuclear? Questions like that.
Yeah. Well, first to your point, I was using the phrase necessary evil when I thought about nuclear power about 15 years ago. In the meantime, I think it's a necessary good. Just to be clear here, I am one of those people enthusiastic about nuclear power, right? That doesn't mean I want the whole world to run on 100% nuclear power or so. That's not likely to happen anyway. So my support for nuclear power is not an attack on renewables or so. They can work together just fine. In fact, I think nuclear is the best option if you want baseload power. So this is power, electricity that is available 24/7. Any modern society needs about 50% or so power that's always available. And we can supplement that with wind and solar, and or even more nuclear or hydro if it's available, and maybe even natural gas. But I don't want to exclude anything here, right? We have a big problem, namely climate change. We have another big, big challenge of providing more and more electricity in a world that's power hungry. So let's start building so people can actually use the energy that they need.
Our guest today has been Marco Vischer, and his book is called The Power of Nuclear, The Rise, Fall, and Return of Our Mightiest Energy Source. I don't often say this about a book like The Power of Nuclear, but literally this is a book you could take on vacation because it's so readable. It is so interesting. It has so much historical perspective, you know, from Ernest Rutherford in New Zealand, you know, the father of nuclear physics, to just little facts that will stick with you and will just enlighten any background knowledge you may or may not have had about nuclear. So, Marco, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Have you ever wondered what lurked beneath the surface of oceans, rivers, and streams during the age of the dinosaurs? Well, Our next guest, Randy Ermus, the curator of paleontology at the Natural History Museum of Utah, joins us now to talk about an upcoming event, the Dino Fest, going on this Saturday at the Natural History Museum of Utah, that uncovers these little-known dinosaurs, or maybe they're not even called dinosaurs. Randy Ermus, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Sure. I think that most of us don't even consider prehistoric life in the ocean. And it just sounds like a whole world that we better uncover here in the next 25 minutes. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like ecosystems today, back during the time of dinosaurs, the underwater world was teeming with life as well. And I think, where folks often have lots of questions is we have all sorts of different creatures living underwater, and are those dinosaurs or are those not dinosaurs? And if not, what are they? Things like that.
Yeah. So you're going to have a keynote speaker, Dr. Laura Wilson, who's going to talk about, I think, primarily an area in sort of the breadbasket area of the U.S. that was once a Great Lake where the fossils have been recovered. What was known about first, the fact that there was water, or were these fossils found? And then that suggested that these vertebrates lived in aqua world.
Yeah, so quite early on in the history of geology, people recognized that there were some sediments that were deposited on land by rivers and streams and things like that, as well as sediments deposited in the ocean. And one of the principal ways they could tell that is by the types of fossils found there. And the water body you're alluding to is called the Western Interior Seaway. And during the late Cretaceous period, it split North America in two, from the Arctic down to the Gulf of Mexico. And certainly we knew about those sediments being ocean sediments before these particular fossils were found. But some of the fossils that Dr. Wilson's going to be talking about were found quite early on in the history of North American paleontology.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking with Randy Ermus. He is the curator of paleontology at the Natural History Museum of Utah, and they've got a big event coming up about the age of dinosaurs. So, Randy, let's remind our listeners about the massive span that dinosaurs existed, because I remember tutoring some kids in geology millions of years ago, pun intended there, and the time frame between the last dinosaurs and the earliest dinosaurs was much broader than the time frame between the last dinosaurs and humans. So remind all of us about this massive, massive chunk of time.
That's exactly right. And this is where sometimes visually a timeline can be really helpful, because it's hard, it's impossible to conceive of what a million years is, let alone 100 million years. But the first dinosaurs appear in the fossil record about 230 million years ago, and the last non-flying dinosaurs went extinct about 66 million years ago. And of course, dinosaurs are still with us as birds, but when we talk about dinosaurs, people are typically thinking of the non-flying type. So with those numbers, if you think about it, a Tyrannosaurus rex or Triceratops that lived 66 million years ago is closer in time to us than it is to the first dinosaur, which is kind of staggering to think about.
Well, you think about, when we think about marine fossils, marine mm-hmm. dinosaurs, marine reptiles, I always think of trilobites. I mean, I think that's the classic prehistoric marine creature that we envision, but they aren't part of your event. Tell us why.
Yeah, so trilobites are a classic marine fossil, and they're beautiful fossils, and Utah has one of the best fossil records of trilobites, particularly from the Cambrian period about 500 million years ago. But that's just it. So turns out trilobites went extinct at the end of the Permian period about 252 million years ago, and so that's about 20 million years before the first dinosaurs.
Wow. It's It's really unfathomable, the timeline, and yet it captures the sort of hearts and imaginations of so many people, especially young people. And I love to see how much knowledge young people have about dinosaurs. And I'm sure you encounter them all the time at the Natural History Museum of Utah. By the way, just a reminder to our listeners, this Saturday, January 25th, there is the Dino Fest. Now, this is a really popular event. Does it sell out? Do you need to get tickets ahead of time?
You don't need to get tickets ahead of time, but it's always advised because it can get quite busy. I don't think we've, you know, officially sold out ever, but it gets busy. And so if you want to make sure you have tickets, I would go to our website and reserve them ahead of time. But you can certainly still show up the day of. And it's both Saturday and Sunday, and we've got amazing stuff going on. Some world-class speakers on both days, as well as all sorts of different events and folks from the community related to dinosaurs. We have the paleontology collections open, so you can see what's behind the scenes, as well as the fossil preparation lab. So there's all sorts of great stuff going on. And we have people that, you know, they're such dinosaur lovers, they come both days.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, so this Saturday and Sunday. And if you've never been to the Natural History Museum of Utah, it is a phenomenal space. It's a beautiful building. It's beautifully located and so many wonderful things to see. And let's just talk a little bit. Let's give an overview. So it starts off at, we mentioned Dr. Laura Wilson, who's going to be talking about surviving Hell's Aquarium. And yeah, starts, so the speakers start at noon on Saturday. And I'd like to, you know, say that, wow, it's really cold this week in Park City. Maybe come Saturday, we'll be sick of the cold. Good time to go inside the warm Natural History Museum of Utah. Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about the rest of the speakers.
Yeah, so we have an amazing lineup of speakers. And the talks start at noon, both Saturday and Sunday, and then go through the mid-afternoon. But of course, the museum's open from 10 to 5 both days, and we've got all sorts of stuff going on in the morning as well. So as you already mentioned, Dr. Laura Wilson is our keynote speaker on Saturday, and then Dr. Dan Sepka, who's an expert in penguin evolution, is our other keynote speaker. And, you know, when we talk about aquatic dinosaurs, we don't want to forget about birds. Birds have been interacting with water for most of their evolutionary history, and penguins are a great example of that.
So, Randy, when I was reading through the list of speakers, Egypt is never a place that comes across my mind as an area you go to find dinosaurs. You know, it's typically archaeology and ancient human history. But tell us about, I'm going to hopefully say her name, Sanaa El-Sayed. She sounds like a fascinating speaker. Tell us about what she's working on.
Yeah, well, I hope everybody comes to the museum and checks out her talk. But Egypt has an amazing fossil record, and particularly from the Cretaceous period, so the third of the three geologic periods that make up the Age of Dinosaurs. And during this time, North Africa was sort of like a coastal mangrove wetlands type environment. And there were lots of different dinosaurs and other animals, you know, turtles and crocodiles and fish living in this environment and interacting with each other. And so that's what Sanaa is going to be talking about, and all of her specific research and field work discovering these ancient ecosystems. She and her team have really provided a huge number of new insights over the last 10-15 years about this area that we really didn't know about before.
That's amazing. Well, and then let's talk about Ichthyosaurus.
Yeah.
I can never get that one off my tongue. And Neil Patrick Kelly, because we've had people on here before that have talked about these massive pods, if you will, of the Ichthyosauruses that they find. Yeah. And this is pretty much a localized, this is very much a local celebrity, if you will, in terms of the type of marine reptile.
That's right. Dr. Kelly is a world expert in ichthyosaur evolution, and is going to be focusing particularly on the early evolution of ichthyosaurs from the Triassic period in Nevada and surrounding areas, where, as you mentioned, we seem to have these really giant ichthyosaurs called Shonisaurus that were living in large groups. And at least in some places where their fossils are preserved, we find very few other marine reptiles, which is unusual. And, you know, why this pattern might be occurring, why these very large predatory ichthyosaurs might be coming together into groups. And of course, what makes ichthyosaurs reptiles, but not dinosaurs. So you often see them included in, you know, dinosaur toys and dinosaur books, but like all marine reptiles, they are other types of reptiles. They are not dinosaurs.
You know, Randy, it's interesting. So often when we go snorkeling or scuba diving or whatever, we see things under the water and in the depths that about which we end up saying, oh, they look so prehistoric, or they look like something from the dinosaur age. And I'm just wondering about the evolution, you know, and maybe it's that we're accustomed to seeing, you know, our modern day animals above land or on land. So what about the evolution of what lives in the water and what lives on the land? Did things evolve more slowly and they continue to seem more similar to what they looked like millions of years ago?
I think, you know, part of it is certainly organisms, animals in the ocean are evolving just as fast as those on land or in the air. But of course, across all of animal life, there's many different rates of evolution, and those rates of evolution change through time. I think there's two components to that. What you brought up, you know, things looking prehistoric. One is the further you get away from mammals, the less, you know, sort of familiar things look to us, right? It's a sort of a bias we have of, you know, we like other furry animals like our pets and whatnot. And the further away you get, the more sort of foreign things look to us. But the other thing is there's a lot of groups that sort of hit upon a general body plan evolutionarily that really works for them, you know, whether you're talking about crocodilians or turtles or things like that. And so once they sort of evolve that body plan, it's a lot of variations on a theme over time in terms of their evolution. And so that's where we often get this sort of, it's unfortunately a bit of a misnomer, the idea of a living fossil, because all organisms are evolving. But for example, if you take crocodilians, for example, there were, you know, back during the age of dinosaurs, there were plenty of crocodilians living in the water like they do today and would have outwardly looked very similar to what we see today. But there are lineages that are long extinct, even though they have that similar body plan. And yet, at the same time, there were actually crocodiles living on land that were herbivores. So there were lots of weird branches of their evolutionary tree we just, you know, aren't as familiar with.
Okay. So in my very naive mind here to the world of dinosaurs, I thought maybe you were going to say in the great extinction that wiped out most of the dinosaurs on the planet, the ones that lived in the water were spared somehow from this.
Well,
especially the ones that lived, you know, thousands of feet down.
That's not a naive question or hypothesis at all. In fact, it has been suggested that animals that lived in the water or lived in burrows and things like that were more likely to survive the end Cretaceous mass extinction. However, we know that aquatic ecosystems were impacted by the extinction event. And so it turns out it's really complicated what survived and what didn't and why they survived. And it may have something to do not only with where you live, but what your diet is, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Randy, another creature that we associate, you know, that seafaring creature that we associate living at the time of dinosaurs, in addition to trilobites, which were way before, are ammonites.
Yes.
And I was fascinated to read that they actually came after dinosaurs. Is that correct?
Not quite. So ammonites, so ammonites and their relatives evolved quite a long time ago. I don't want to say the exact time because I'm going to get it wrong, but you know, back in the Paleozoic era, so well before dinosaurs, and then the last ammonites went extinct at the same time as the dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous. But there are there's a parallel group of mollusks that are called nautiloids that are alive today in the chambered nautilus, and they look very, very similar to ammonites. So, but we had ammonites living alongside dinosaurs for their entire evolutionary history.
Okay, or swimming alongside, if
yeah,
you will.
Swimming alongside,
in this case.
Yeah, that's a good, yeah.
So do you have a favorite underwater, either dinosaur or marine reptile?
Oh boy, I'm really horrible at picking favorites, but I have a soft spot for crocodilians and their relatives. And there's this whole group of crocodilians during the time of dinosaurs that evolved to live in the ocean full time, called Thalassocheans. And there's one that's had this, you know, imagine basically like a T-Rex like head on a on a crocodile body, called Dacosaurus, that's really really unusual looking, and you know, basically ate whatever it could fit in its mouth.
I love it. Okay, so on Saturday and Sunday at the Dino Fest this weekend at the Natural History Museum of Utah, you also have, so you've got these keynote addresses, but then you have all of these Dino Bites, which are just shorter talks. Is that right?
Correct. And okay, they're all by experts in the field. So.
Okay. We talked about some of them. And what have we missed? How about one on Saturday by Kate Ritterbusch, bringing fossils to life with robots and video games? Are there new, more constructive video games out there for our young people and even us?
Absolutely. Yeah. So my colleague, Dr. Ritterbusch from the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Utah, is a paleontologist who specializes in studying these marine environments during the time of dinosaurs, and particularly how ammonites swam, and has been doing some really amazing research, as alluded to, using robots and stuff, and then also putting that into a video game. So you absolutely need to come and check out her talk and all the other speakers as well.
Oh, that sounds really great. Well, I always love to ask paleontologists how they got interested in this field. Did it start from, you know, being a three-year-old and someone gave you a little plastic figurine of Tyrannosaurus Rex or something, and then you just followed your dream from there? Or does it have some other turn and twist?
It's definitely that sort of typical story. I started out interested in dinosaurs and rocks and fossils as a little kid. And I guess I never grew up, but somehow now I'm employed as a paleontologist, which is pretty amazing. You know, there's no single event I can point to. Just since I can remember, I've always been fascinated by it.
Randy, let's talk about one more of your guests, Andrew Milner. We had him on the show not too long ago after they had discovered those fossils around Lake Powell. Tell us more about that, because this will be great for our listeners to go and actually see what he was talking about.
Well, yeah, that's really interesting. So the fossils that got talked about a little bit a few months ago from Lake Powell, or maybe it was a year ago now, I can't remember exactly. Those are of some mammal ancestors called Tritylodonts that were living in a desert environment in the early Jurassic period. And so despite being found around a large lake, they are things living on land, but there are rocks in other layers just above and below that layer that are more were deposited by water, mostly by rivers and streams. And these preserve lots of dinosaur footprints, including footprints that were made underwater. So we don't have any dinosaurs that were fully aquatic, but we know that dinosaurs entered the water and were swimming because of these types of trackways called swim tracks. And that's what Andrew will be talking about.
We've talked on the show today about marine reptiles and dinosaurs, and they're two very different things, two very different creatures. What is the difference between that, so our listeners can go down and be very educated as they go to your presentations?
So if you, the way to think about it is think about your own family tree, right? Your family is all related, but you know, your aunt and uncle are one branch of the family, you know, your cousins, second cousins are another branch of the family. And it's similar to that. So all of these animals, for the most part, that we talked about are reptiles. So they all belong to the reptile part of the family tree, but they're different branches of that reptile family tree. So just like today we have different branches, turtles and crocodilians and lizards, the same thing was true back during the age of dinosaurs. And so dinosaurs, including birds, are one branch of the reptile family tree. And then these other marine reptiles are actually not just one, but several different other branches of the reptile family tree. So for example, mosasaurs, which are these sort of eel-like reptiles that lived in the ocean towards the end of the age of dinosaurs, they're actually ocean-going lizards. They evolved from animals closely related to modern Komodo dragons and monitor lizards.
Dr. Randy Ermus has been our guest. He's the curator of paleontology at the Natural History Museum of Utah. And Dino Fest is coming up this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, the 25th and 26th. And lots of interesting speakers and things to see, and always new things to discover at the Natural History Museum of Utah. You can go to their website, which is nhmu.utah.edu. Is that right?
Absolutely. You got it.
And you can buy your tickets there or show up and buy them on site. So, Randy, great pleasure to speak with you again. Thanks so much for all that you do.
Oh, thanks again for having me, and I hope to see everybody at Dino Fest at the museum this weekend.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Thanks to our guest today, journalist Marco Vischer, and The Power of Nuclear, his new book, very interesting book. And then Randy Ermus, the curator of paleontology at the Natural History Museum of Utah.